Let's go, girls.
Welcome to the AmeriChicks with Kim Monson and Molly Vogt. Molly is a former mutual fund consultant and retirement plan specialist who is currently the director and founder of My Purse Politics. Kim served as a city councilwoman, is a former investment broker, and now a successful entrepreneur. Now, let's hear what's hatching in local and national politics with the AmeriChicks, Molly and Kim.
Well, I do declare it may be time to talk about where rights come from, and it may be time to talk about what our founding fathers thought it was so important to be able to get your ideas out, to really express yourself. Why they thought it was important to really make the case for your ideas and your ideals, and to make sure that the people around you were with you before you, let's say, nudge and take on the greatest army in the entire world. We want to make sure that our ideas are heard and understood. And, you know, I think that's so amazing and awesome that our founding fathers did it in such a gentlemanly way. And we could learn a lot about that today. This is the AmeriChicks, Molly and Kim. I'm Molly.
And I'm Kim.
And, you know, we like to look at issues that really matter to people today. And we dissect them as right versus wrong instead of right versus left. Because in America, absolutely every single person here should be treated equally under the law. And in order to understand that, we want to know where our law comes from. What were our founding fathers thinking of when they wrote it? And what makes us different from other countries around the world? Why did we break up with the King of England? So this is kind of our breakup show. We're going to talk about it. If you want to break up with somebody, then we're going to teach you the right way to do it. We're going to have a little help with Rob Nadelson. I think he's probably better at explaining it than I am. And Kim, and you, as you and I have talked about in the past, I'm not the best at breaking up.
Well,
in the couthest of ways.
Well, it's difficult to do that. But it was just so amazing. The colonists decided that they were going to let King George know why. And so there's a whole bunch of reasons in there. And we have in studio with us Rob Nadelson. He's Senior Fellow in Constitutional Jurisprudence at Independence Institute. And studies of the Constitution's original meaning have been relied upon repeatedly by the Supreme Court of the United States. He's taught law for 25 years. He is the author of the original Constitution, what it actually said and meant. So, Rob Nadelson, welcome.
It's great to be back.
It's great to have you here. Now, many times we talk about the first few paragraphs of the Declaration, but there's some real guts in there. I thought there were 27 reasons why they decided to break up with King George, and I've heard it's 26, 20. What is it exactly?
They're all right. People count them differently.
Okay.
It just depends on where you divide them.
Okay. But there's 27 reasons why the colonists finally said to King George, we're breaking up. And it was a long breakup. I mean, they really didn't want to for a long time, right?
That's right. In 1763, at the close of the French and Indian War, the colonists were pretty happy. They were happy with the British Empire. They were happy to be British subjects. They had been enjoying a great deal of self-government, but they were very proud to be part of the largest empire in the world. Unfortunately, in 12 short years between 1763 and 1775, the British managed to mishandle the situation so badly, and that's not just my view, that's the view of British historians as well, that war broke it out in 1775. It was quite a downward spiral. War continued throughout 1775. There was no real effort by Britain to mediate or adjust the conflict in any meaningful way. Basically, their offer was, if you submit, we'll pull our troops out, some of them anyway. And so finally, the colonists decided they'd had enough, and they declared to a candid world, as they said, the reasons that impel the separation.
It's astonishing that these farmers and merchants and lawyers and these individuals up and down the Eastern Seaboard would decide to actually make a declaration for independence against the largest, most powerful empire on the face of the earth. I mean, it's astonishing to me, Rob.
Well, it is astonishing in some ways. It's probably most astonishing that the United States was a country, probably the first country, created by an active conscious will of its people. It didn't just evolve. It didn't result from conquest. It was a conscious decision by the voting public at the time to separate. However, the sides were not quite as uneven as you might think. The colonists represented about 28-29% of the population of the empire. Philadelphia was the third largest city in the empire after London and Bristol. The colonists, of course, had the advantage that if Britain wanted to reduce them to obedience, they were going to have to ship an army over 3,000 miles and provision it. It's going to be difficult. The colonists were in a position to be able to fight a guerrilla war. And the colonists were wealthy. At the time, the American colonies were almost certainly the most prosperous area of real estate on Earth. And the North American British colonists were about the wealthiest people on Earth, at least on an average basis. So while it was an uneven contest, it wasn't quite so uneven as we sometimes think.
Just a question, Rob. You said the colonists were very wealthy, and the British Empire reached to all corners of the earth. Why were the colonists wealthy? Because I've always thought that the American idea is what had really made colonists, you know, North American or Americans wealthy. But you're saying that even before independence, that was the case. Why?
That's right. Well, they were self-governing. There was a great deal of personal freedom. Anybody who came to America probably was someone with a good amount of get up and go. So this is a self-selected population. The land was rich. There was a labor shortage, severe labor shortage, which had the effect of bidding up wages.
Okay.
So the colonists were very well off compared to people in most of the world.
Okay, well, let's keep the conversation going. We're going to go to break. We're with Rob Nadelson. We'll be right back.
If you're a veteran looking to purchase a home, choose the local experts at Home Mortgage Alliance. VA loans offer qualifying veterans the option to buy without a down payment, and closing fees are limited. Active duty or retired military, reserves, and surviving spouses may qualify. Kim Sturtz and Mark Cook have spent decades finding the correct loan to suit your unique financial situation. Give Home Mortgage Alliance a call at 303-888-2732. That's 303-888-2732. Or check them out on our AmeriChicks referral list at AmeriChicks.com.
Home Mortgage Alliance LLC is an approved FHA lender and sponsored agent of VA loans. NMLS number 1137507.
When buying or selling your home, you need a top-notch negotiator with experience. Award-winning RE/MAX Alliance Realtor Karen Levine has helped individuals navigate the ups and downs of the Denver real estate market for over 25 years. Karen Levine is honest, trustworthy, and has your best interests in mind. Let Karen help you find the right home for your lifestyle. Call Karen at 303-877-7516 for a no-cost consultation. That's 303-877-7516, or visit her online at Karen-Levine.com and tell her the AmeriChicks sent you.
Today, you need to have a great online and social media presence, and the best in the biz is Desi On Demand. The AmeriChicks, Molly and Kim, personally work with Brandon, the founder of Desi On Demand. Desi On Demand is instrumental with our video projects, Chick Chat, Eggs, Exceptional Endeavors, and our World War II project. We most heartily endorse his creativity, innovation, dedication, and integrity. Brandon and his team bring all that to the table. Check out Desi On Demand's website at mydesi.com or call 303-359-1522 for more info, and be sure to tell them the AmeriChicks sent you.
Bookkeeping, accounting, and taxes, oh my! No need to worry about your company or personal finances with the proven professionals at Predovich & Company. Predovich & Company are certified public accountants who offer exceptional services to individuals, businesses, and nonprofits. Serving the South Metro area, the team at Predovich & Company strives to take a proactive approach in understanding your tax, accounting, and bookkeeping needs and situation. Give Predovich & Company a call at 303-791-3000 or check out their website at dpredovich.com and be sure to tell them the AmeriChicks sent you.
We now return to the AmeriChicks, Molly and Kim, on KDMT, Denver's Money Talk, 1690 AM.
Hey, this is the AmeriChicks, Molly and Kim, on KDMT. You know, it's Independence Day time. You know, we've recently just passed the 73rd anniversary of D-Day. And we know that it took a lot of sacrifice to get out from underneath the tyranny of Nazi Germany and for many people. And it took a lot of Americans and our allies sacrifice to help with that. And we want to make sure we don't get that far again, so we don't have to go through that kind of a war, because war is hell. And, you know, and it's, you know, 4th of July. It's around 4th of July time right now, which is the Declaration of Independence. And this is the time that we broke up with the King of England back in 1776. And I thought it would be interesting for us to kind of talk about why we decided to do that and what were the list of abuses and usurpations and the injuries and usurpations that our founding fathers listed against the King of England, why they wanted to break up. One more thing real quick before we get into that. And this is Molly and Kim. We have in studio with us Rob Nadelson. You know the voice, you know the name, you've probably heard many Supreme Court justices look to him and read his works when they come up with their cases. He's done a lot of work on the Constitution and telling people what it means. But, you know, there are so many different countries around the world that they go through civil wars over and over and over. And it seems very easy, just when I see it's like another civil war. There's just another group that wants to come to power. And it seems like it happens quite easily. But when I look at the Declaration of Independence and I see at the very beginning, you see, our founding father said, you know, common sense said governments, which have been around a long time, shouldn't be changed just for minor little reasons. That, you know, they're not going to go fight for something small. It's really going to have to be a long string of abuses. It's going to have to really be government chipping away at freedoms. It's going to be a really big deal for us to pull out. And so that's why I thought it was important to talk about America, because we are different than anywhere else in the world. And that's why so many people risk their lives to come here. But we want to remember what's so great about us and what usurpations we thought were bad then. So, Rob Nadelson, let's get into the usurpations a little bit. Do you mind walking us through some?
Sure. And Molly, I think it's really important that we do this topic, because there's been so much focus on the beautiful initial statement of natural law at the beginning of the Declaration, and then the passage about sacred honor at the end of the Declaration. But the usurpations are really the core of the document. And the idea of listing a number of causes actually is part of the English heritage. At the same time they're separating from England, they're following their English heritage, in that the English Bill of Rights also has a list of usurpations. So it's a way of declaring to the world the reasons for what the Americans are doing. That is, this isn't just about power or wealth or something. This is about something more deep. Let's just take one at random. Okay.
Okay.
He has refused.
And he is King George.
No,
right?
King George. Actually, take a side. He has forbidden his governors to pass laws of immediate and pressing importance unless suspended in their operation till his assent should be obtained. And when so suspended, he is utterly neglected to attend to them. Now, under the British Constitution, the king had a veto. Like the president can veto laws, the king could veto laws. And the grievance here is the colonial assemblies were passing laws to deal with local problems, then sending them to London for the royal assent, and the royal assent is never forthcoming. It's neither vetoed or approved in some cases, and in other cases, it's simply vetoed.
And what was the reason?
That's a very good question. The reason would have depended upon different circumstances, but let me give you one example. There was a great shortage of money in the colonies. The colonies had very booming economies, and there wasn't enough circulating medium. There wasn't enough cash to keep up with the economic growth, and so the colonies wanted to establish a mint, or in what became the United States, and they wanted to be able to circulate paper currency. And laws to that effect, when sent to England, generally were not attended to or vetoed. As a result, the Americans became very cash poor. They had to resort to barter, mm-hmm, in order to make their economy work. They bartered with wampum beads, or they bartered with tobacco, or they bartered with rice, because the British hadn't allowed them to develop their own circulating medium, their own coinage. So that's a good example.
So there would be lots of frustration.
Lots of frustration. Mm-hmm. And there's another account related to this. He has refused his assent to laws the most wholesome and necessary for the public good. Let's take another one. He has dissolved representative houses repeatedly for opposing with manly firmness his invasions on the rights of the people. Each colony had an upper house, which generally, not in all cases, but it generally was appointed by the governor with the approval of the crown, and a lower house where the real power lay, which was elected by the people. Well, through the lower house, people would make their objections known. Legislation would be passed, petitions would be presented, and he would instruct his royal governors to simply dissolve, that is to adjourn. Mandatorily, the lower house, which he had a right to do under the Constitution, under the British Constitution. But it was a power that really should have been used in a much mm-hmm. more guarded manner.
Sure.
Anytime the colonists become upset with what's going on, they're rewarded by having their lower house dissolved. So obviously this interferes with self-governance, the kind of self-governance the colonists had become accustomed to in the years before approximately 1773.
And again, frustration.
Yes.
You can see.
One frustration after another.
Yeah.
There was another ground mentioned. Virginia didn't want slaves flooding into Virginia for a number of different reasons. So they tried to pass legislation restricting the slave trade. Well, this was dissatisfying. This was distasteful to the British, who wanted to continue the slave trade and who profited from the slave trade. And so, again, the Virginia laws were vetoed.
So that would have been during the time of Wilberforce and Newton?
No, long before that.
It was long before that?
Yeah.
Okay, because
yeah.
that was...
There was strong sentiment in Virginia for ending the slave trade, to making do with the slaves they had. There were several different reasons for that, some of them idealistic and some of them self-interested. But the point is that the British wanted to continue this slave trade. Virginia, at least, and some other colonies wanted to stop it.
Okay. Well, okay, what's another one then out of the 27 reasons that they wanted to break up with King George? We have Rob Nadelson in studio with us. And as you probably know, he is a fellow in constitutional jurisprudence at the Independence Institute. He is an authority on the Constitution, and repeatedly the Supreme Court of the United States will go to him for trying to find out his thoughts about the Constitution. So,
well, Kim, here's one. This is particularly timely to today. He, meaning King George, has erected a multitude of new offices and sent hither swarms of officers to harass our people and eat out their substance.
It sounds like bureaucracies and agencies, alphabet soup.
I think last time I was on, we said that in Britain and America, the attitude was bureaucracy was something that happened in France. Well, here you have the British government sending bureaucrats over here, inspection officers, people to combat smuggling, taxing officers, to administer things like not the stamp tax, that had been repealed, but the tax on tea, judicial officers of various kinds. You see, at the time, the British Constitution, the British Parliament, operated on a principle that was called the corruption principle. The basic idea was that the government, meaning the prime minister and his cabinet, stayed in power by paying off members of Parliament and their family members. And one way to pay them off was to give them an office in America, you see. So you give them this office in America, and then they can sort of take the salary, and maybe there wasn't much work to be done. So this was the plan, at least according to Ben Franklin. The plan was to turn America into this big reservoir or plantation for the raising of booty to pay off people so that the current Tory government could stay in power. Okay.
Ben Franklin?
Ben Franklin said that was the plan.
It was all about
turning America into a source of patronage, into a source of political loot.
Okay, got it.
And so this is a complaint against that.
But I'm confused, Rob Nadelson, because you said, you know, when we started to go through the Declaration of Independence and declare, you know, and list our usurpations, it's because things had changed.
Right.
So at the beginning, they weren't abusing us. At the very beginning, so what changed? I mean, when did this change? When did the King of England really start to abuse America?
Well, let's get behind the Declaration to a fact that is never actually explicitly mentioned in the Declaration. It wasn't so much the king, although he was guilty too. It was Parliament.
Oh,
see, there's a comment in there about how the king has combined with others to exercise an unwarranted jurisdiction over us. It was really Parliament that was behind a lot of this stuff, but the colonists did not recognize the jurisdiction of Parliament over the colonists. For the most part. They recognized that the king was their king. The king was their executive. But as far as they were concerned, for most purposes, their legislatures were not Parliament. It was the colonial legislatures. Mm-hmm. And it was Parliament that was taking the position after 1763 that the colonists were subordinate to Parliament. And so you see a succession of pieces of legislation passed in order to tax the colonies, in order to make the colonies pay for armies that would help defend the colonies, legislation passed to regulate the colonies in various ways. You see, what changed was after 1763 was the year that the British Empire prevailed over the French, the end of the French and Indian War. That's the beginning of the time when Parliament starts turning its attention to the colonies and saying, you know, how can we turn the colonies into a source of revenue? How can we make the colonies pay more for their own defense? How can we make the colonies a source of patronage? So that's what changed.
Mm. Rob Nadelson, this sounds a lot like America today.
There actually are striking parallels.
Because, okay, so let me ask you this question, and then I want to ask you about Article 5. Because during this time, say 1763, when Parliament started to take so much power, were there checks and balances in place? Could the king have done something to slow down Parliament?
Yes, and in fact, that is actually alluded to in the Declaration, that the king had not used his veto and his patronage power to check these efforts by Parliament. On the contrary, he was a co-conspirator.
Okay. So this is the AmeriChicks, Molly and Kim on KDMT. We're talking with Rob Nadelson about the Declaration of Independence. Stick with us. When we come back, there might be some things that we need to look at today.
Have a great night out and watch the best movies under the stars at the historic 88 Drive-In Theater. Beginning Friday, June 30th, the triple feature at 88 Drive-In will include Despicable Me 3, The Mummy, and Wonder Woman. Admission is $8 per person and children under 12 are free. Stay for one or all three. And be sure to visit their delicious snack bar to help 88 Drive-In Theater continue to bring you the best in movie entertainment. Get their special pizza deal Monday through Thursday. Receive one 12-inch pizza and two 16-ounce sodas, all for only $11. Stay up to date on movie showings and times at 88drivein.net and be sure to tell them the AmeriChicks sent you.
Hey, welcome back to the AmeriChicks with Molly Vogt and Kim Munson. You know, we're the AmeriChicks because we care about America and we think it's important for everybody to understand how America came to be and how we became to be free and why we thought it was important and why we created the government we did with the checks and balances in place. And in order to do that, we've brought in studio with us today Rob Nadelson, who's Senior Fellow in Constitutional Jurisprudence at the Independence Institute. He also wrote a book I have right in front of me. Go get it. It's The Original Constitution, What It Actually Said and Meant. Pretty, pretty awesome to be able to go back in time and to get into our founding fathers' heads and think, what were they thinking at the time? What were their values? What law did they already understand at the time? So that's really great for understanding it. And of course, you know, our own Supreme Court justices look to Rob Nadelson as an expert when they are deciding cases. So he's a great guy. We always come up with something new here. So, you know, we're talking about the usurpations that America's founding fathers and our colonists were listing when they were breaking up with Great Britain in 1776. And, you know, I was going back thinking, okay, the Stamp Act, the king was taxing us, we had no representation, and all of these types of things, but it was so much more than that. And we're going through the list in the declaration that they listed. So everybody pull out your Declaration of Independence and start going through those or check it out online.
Unless you're driving,
then wait till you get home. But one of the interesting things, Rob, you said right before you went to break, I was thinking, okay, so the king was abusing his power, but you said really it was the Parliament that was most powerful there, and not really the king, and it was hard to get rid of the Parliament. So they were the guys in charge, and I just wondered, you know, how was there any other alternative other than a revolution to make changes in how the American colonies were being ruled by Great Britain at the time? It didn't look like there was an Article 5 that we have now for us to make any changes.
Well, Molly, first I need to clarify something. We can't go into the weeds on the British Constitution as it existed at that time. But the balance of power between Parliament and the King at that time was about what it became between Congress and the President. Okay? So they're both quite powerful, and they're both involved, they're both responsible for this train of abuses. I was simply making the point that while the Declaration blames the king, because the colonists recognized the king as their king before declaring independence, the Declaration does not mention Parliament explicitly, because the colonists never recognized the jurisdiction of Parliament over America with respect to both to most items. So, but they're both responsible for these problems. Now, you're right to say that there were inadequate alternatives. There were inadequate checks and balances. The colonists could not vote for members of Parliament. It would not particularly have been practical for them to vote for members of Parliament. Even in Great Britain, the franchise, the suffrage, was very limited. And Parliament was essentially chosen by, you know, maybe probably less than 100,000 people. There was no way in which the colonies could check Parliament other than by sending lobbyists, really, to Parliament, or by doing things that the colonists tried to do, like refuse to trade with Britain as a way of making their displeasure known. So the Constitution tried to remedy this problem by giving the states a number of tools for dealing with the federal government that the colonists did not have for dealing with their central government. And one of those tools, as you mentioned, possibly the most important one, is mentioned in the amendment provision of the Constitution, Article 5, which enables the states to force the calling of a meeting called a convention to propose constitutional amendments that the states can then later on go ahead and ratify. It was stuck in the Constitution as a way of reining in the power of Congress and avoiding any necessity for a popular revolution.
Mm-hmm. And Rob Nadelson, you basically just made the case for me for Brexit as well, and for sovereignty, because if we don't have a way to really hold our own government accountable to us other than via, you know, trade restrictions and lobbyists, and so it's a money game, then we're not really a free country.
Yeah, and the Brits pulled Brexit at a, one could argue, at the last possible moment. They were becoming subsumed in a European bureaucracy with very, you know, very nominal attention to democratic forms. There's a European Parliament, but it's really the bureaucracy that runs things. And fortunately, the Brits rediscovered their history and recognized that, you know, we're going to be in a situation worse than the Americans were in before 1776, unless we do something now.
And so they were able to make that exit peacefully.
They were able to at least initiate it peacefully. We'll see what effect the recent British election has.
Okay. Rob, someone had told me that of the 27-ish usurpations in the Declaration, that the Constitution was put in place to actually address each of these. Is that correct?
I think that's a little bit too pat.
Okay.
There are certainly many aspects that that are mentioned in usurpations that have solutions in the Declaration in the Constitution. Let's take the royal veto. One of the complaints was that the king failed to respond in a timely manner with either his veto or his signature. Well, the Constitution deals with that by putting a time limit mm-hmm. within which the president has to veto or sign. If he doesn't respect the time limit, then the matter becomes law. Also, the Constitution contains a provision whereby two-thirds of both houses of Congress can override the president's veto. The royal veto could not be overridden. It was absolute. Also, the Constitution provides for distribution of members of the House of Representatives among states in a manner roughly equivalent to population. The British Parliament was very, very malapportioned, with many people having no vote at all. So those are things alluded to directly or indirectly in the Declaration that are responded to in the Constitution. But you can't simply go through the Declaration and say, well, here's abuse number one, solved this way, usurpation number one, solved that way. And by the way, we need to distinguish here between what they refer to as abuses and what they refer to as usurpations. An abuse is an improper or bad use of a legitimate power. So they recognize that the king had a legitimate power to veto, but he was abusing that power. A usurpation, on the other hand, is an exercise of power that is not at all legitimate, like the attempt of the English Parliament to legislate for America. That was viewed as a usurpation. At another part of the Declaration, there's a reference to injuries and usurpations. Usurpations, again, means the same thing. And by injuries, they're referring to abuses, legitimate power improperly used.
Mm-hmm. Rob Nadelson, check out his book, by the way, The Original Constitution, what it actually said and meant. He is a senior fellow in constitutional jurisprudence at Independence Institute right here in Colorado. You know, a lot of people, when we talk about the Constitution, say, oh, it's a living, breathing document and we don't really need it anymore. And the things that it protects, we don't really need those protections anymore. But one of the favorite things I like about our Constitution is that it gets rid of cruel and unusual punishment. I like that one because I think that still exists in other parts of the world. But I'm looking through the Declaration here in the list of abuses, and one of them is depriving us in many cases of the benefits of trial by jury. Tell us what was going on at that time, because here it seems like, oh yeah, you're in trouble, you go to court, but it wasn't like that then.
Well, in the British legal system, there was a court called the Court of Admiralty that was designed to handle matters involving ships and navigation. And one of the frustrations that the British had was that Americans were smuggling goods into the colonies in violation of the British trade laws. A great example was the famous John Hancock. He was, in part, a professional smuggler. Well, when the British would charge these people in an American court, the Americans' juries would often acquit them. So, all the right wasn't on the side of the Americans, as in any context.
There's that human nature component,
right.
Huh?
So what the British decided to do is they said, we're not going to have these smuggling offenses tried in colonial courts by colonial juries anymore. We're going to either ship people to England for trial or ship them to Halifax, Nova Scotia, where they will be tried by an admiralty court. And also, we're going to start setting up admiralty courts in the colonies to try these cases. Now, by traditional law, when you were tried in an admiralty court, there was no jury. You see, the British legal system did not provide for juries in all cases, as the American legal system, which is its successor, doesn't provide for juries in all cases. So that's what they were doing. They were trying to move these cases away from American juries before a British judge with no jury at all.
Fascinating. We are with Rob Nadelson. We'll be right back.
In a world of uncertainty, anything can happen. It pays to protect yourself, your family, your business, your home, and your car. And it pays to work with the proven professionals at Alliance Insurance Services. Jeremy McCallum and his Alliance Insurance Services team work with a variety of insurance companies competing for your business. Jeremy and the Alliance Insurance Services team helps you find the right insurance at the right price. They know you'll sleep better at night knowing Alliance Insurance Services is handling all of your insurance needs. Give them a call today at 303-431-9351. That's 303-431-9351. And be sure to tell them the AmeriChicks sent you.
Freedom begins in your house, not the White House. We Americans enjoy the privileges of a free society, and each of us has a duty and responsibility to keep America's unique ideals of freedom on course. How? Lens of Liberty can help. Lens of Liberty's free freedom kit provides a complete guide to help you be informed, stay vigilant, and fight back for liberty. Order your free freedom kit from lensofliberty.org now. That's lensofliberty.org, so you are armed with the tools necessary to stand for America's ideals.
Hey, welcome back to the AmeriChicks, Molly and Kim. I'm Molly.
And I'm Kim.
And we're talking about the Declaration of Independence today and a little bit into the Constitution. And when you go through the list of the different reasons that our founding fathers wanted to break up basically with Great Britain is because there are many different rights that seem like were being walked on. And, you know, one of the things that they answered in the Constitution was a right that I feel is very important to protect forever. And that's why I am really glad that our Constitution remains to be judged in its original meaning by our founding fathers, because I think that if it were a living, breathing document, some things might be changed. And one of the big ones I want to make sure is not changed is the Ninth Amendment to the United States Constitution. I'm sorry. The Eighth Amendment to the Constitution, because it says it protects me against cruel and unusual punishment. And Kim, you and I have talked to a couple of people who lived through concentration camps mm-hmm. during World War II. And I have heard really, really terrible stories about cruel and unusual punishment. And actually, these things still go on today around the world under different laws that don't protect people's individual rights. So, Rob Nadelson, you are an expert on the Constitution. Talk to us a little bit about this cruel and unusual punishment. Why was it so necessary that our founding fathers thought important to put in the U.S. Constitution?
Well, it is, in fact, part of our British heritage. Cruel and unusual punishments had been a feature of English law in the 1500s, for example, under Henry VIII. And so when the English Bill of Rights was adopted in 1689, it forbade cruel and unusual punishments. And so we adopted the same protection. The British Constitution, however, is this living, breathing document that can ultimately be changed by Parliament if Parliament is determined enough. So Parliament could abolish that particular protection. They could simply repeal part of the British Bill of Rights, English Bill of Rights. The American legislature, the Congress, can't do that. That's the advantage of having a written constitution enforced by the courts. And when we wrote our own constitution, we made a conscious decision that we wanted a written constitution that the politicians were subservient to, that we did not want the British style. So those folks who simply want to abolish the U.S. Constitution and go to a purely living, breathing document, I think Britain would accept them as immigrants, but their attitude is really more British than ours.
And so is Britain a democracy? And I think we need to explain the difference between a democracy and constitutional republic. I will tell you, Rob, I have been in meetings where there are some really smart people that refer to us as a democracy instead of a constitutional republic,
well,
and they
actually
should know better.
Actually, Kim, I'm going to disappoint you here. We're both. The term democracy and republic were used pretty interchangeably at the founding era. The alleged distinction distinction between the two arose out of conflicts in the 1840s. As to your answer as to what we are, we're a modified democracy, a constitutional democracy. We're also a constitutional republic. The United Kingdom is a modified democracy as well, but they're a constitutional monarchy. So their head of state is a king. And they have checks and balances, as we have checks and balances, but they're of a different kind. For example, the British Constitution gives the House of Lords the power not to block ultimately legislation, but to slow it down, to prevent mob rule. It's in the same way that we have a bicameral legislature designed to slow down mobocracy, you know, mob rule. I think we have more checks and balances because we not only we have three independent branches, which the Brits don't have, and we have a federal system which includes states with real power, which Great Britain doesn't have. But the answer is, yeah, we're both modified democracies. They're a constitutional monarchy. That's their way of checking democracy. We're a constitutional republic. That's our way of checking democracy.
Okay, Rob, I have some other questions that really aren't on the usurpation component. So maybe we need to stay focused on that and have you come back. So we're coming in on the end of the show. What other usurpations should we talk about from the Declaration of Independence?
I think one of the most important ones has to do with the presumed power of Congress to tax the colonies. Now, this was absolutely core to the grievances that the colonists had. One of the rights that they viewed as part of their English heritage was that the people should agree to any taxation, either personally agree to it or agree to their elected representatives. In England, this right was protected through the House of Commons, the lower branch of Parliament. In this country, it was protected in that the colonial assemblies elected by the people could impose taxes on the people. But the British Parliament, where they had no members elected by Americans, presumed to tax the colonies. And that was a core grievance. We see today the erosion of this part of our inheritance with bureaucracies and it being able to impose fees without direct popular approval, with increasingly the executive power able to impose charges. For example, the Colorado Secretary of State has been permitted by the Colorado Supreme Court to impose business charges without approval by the legislature. When you read and you understand the abuses and usurpations that are listed in the Declaration of Independence, you learn a lot about the philosophical foundations and the protections in our own government, which is an excellent reason for reading not just the beginning and end of the Declaration, but the difficult stuff in the middle as well.
Okay, so Rob Nadelson, real quick, to make sure I got that right. So 1765, the Stamp Act, we're very upset we're taxed without representation. But you said that at that time in the UK, the House of Commons protected the United Kingdom, but they did not protect the American colonies.
That's right. In theory, the House of Commons was the people's branch. The level of democracy was very imperfect. Relatively few people could vote. But there was still a certain truth to that. But there was no truth at all to the view that the House of Commons protected Americans. Americans voted for the lower houses and sometimes the upper houses of their colonial assemblies. They didn't vote for the House of Commons. So there simply was not the representation that Americans viewed as central to their heritage in requiring representation before that you could be taxed.
Okay.
So, Rob, we're talking about taxation, and it was very frustrating for the colonists to be taxed without representation. So, of course, as America was founded, we have the Constitution and the balance of powers and all of this. I feel that as we moved to a bureaucratic administrative state here in America, that we're back to, in a way, taxation without representation. How would you address that?
Yeah, I think there's some truth to that, and in fact, I already just did address it. But as we talked at the beginning of the program, the colonists in 1763 were very happy. The colonies were essentially self-governing units within this larger British Empire. It was the attempt of Parliament, of politicians and bureaucrats in London, to concentrate all power in the in in the Washington, D.C. of the day, mm-hmm. in London, that triggered the revolution. We have to use the constitutional tools available to us to make sure that we don't result in a replay of history where the choice is between tyranny on the one side and revolution on the other side. And we have to do this as citizens informed about our constitutional rights and our prerogatives as Americans.
Well, and a great way to do that is obviously, Molly, to read the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. But Rob Nadelson has written this book, The Original Constitution, What It Actually Said and Meant. And we would highly recommend that people get this book. Now, where can they get the book?
You can pick it up at Amazon.com. And I want to tell both of you, I really appreciate the plug. The book is an objective look at what the Constitution really meant. It's not a lot of my politics in it. It's more of a historical and legal work than anything else.
But
it's written for the layperson.
Do you know if any teachers are using this?
Well, as a matter of fact, my understanding is that there's a school, a charter school in Fort Collins that uses it for some of their high school kids.
Okay, I think that's great. And, you know, parents...
But it's a little tough going for high school kids. My recommendation for this book is, you know, adults should read it and they should pick at it. They should read the parts that interest them. It's kind of hard to start from the beginning and read through because there's some jargon you have to get through.
The other book that I have this book right here by Rob Nadelson, The Original Constitution, What It Actually Said and Meant. I also have The Constitution for Dummies, of which Molly had to mention to me the other day that she saw that on my bookshelf.
Yeah. Good. How's that going? But, you know, I think it's important to look at the Declaration, to look at the Constitution as well. And when you're reading the beginning of the Declaration of Independence and really the reason why our founding father said that it may become time at some point to actually stand up for yourself and stand up against tyranny if it becomes too much. Don't do it just, you know, on a whim, but do it if it's really important. But some facts that everybody needs to remember, and I think people should remember this in America, we were all created equal. We were born with certain rights that cannot be taken away from us unless we voluntarily transfer them away. So know your rights. Find out where they come from. They don't come from government. In America, we've given certain rights by choice to our government, very limited rights, and the Constitution limits them, and they are accountable to us, to we the people. If they don't do the right thing, then it's our job to replace them. Elections have consequences. Stay engaged, stay involved. I know politics is boring, but every single decision a politician makes affects your life and mine, your family, your welfare, your kids, education, healthcare, everything. This is the AmeriChicks, Molly and Kim. What's your quote to sign off, Kim?
Well, it's the last sentence of the Declaration. And for the support of this Declaration, with a firm reliance on the protection of the divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor.
Hoo-ah! This is the AmeriChicks signing off. We'll talk to you tomorrow, 5 to 6. Girl.